Thanks, Chris. If you've got a Bible, you can turn it to Colossians, is where we're going to start. If you don't have a Bible, don't worry, we'll have it up on the screens, and also a note with Bibles. If you want one or need one, we have some back on that table as well that you can grab and take with you. If you need a Bible in your house, it's a great, very readable translation that you can have if there's need for that in your home. You can do that. Well, we're going to spend these next 2 weeks in Colossians. Chris asked me to do a couple weeks and gave me kind of free rein to jump into wherever I felt would be best. And so I decided to do Colossians 1 because with 2 weeks, it's relatively short. Even with this, we're not going to cover all of Colossians in 2 weeks. That would be exceedingly ambitious. Plus, we all want lunch, right? And not here. Or you could go downstairs, I guess. But we could bring it up. We could stick around for a few hours. We could do that. We won't. But Colossians is one of Paul's letters. And to place it in kind of the sequence of Paul's letters, it is a different, it's kind of a unique letter. Romans, another one of Paul's letters, is much more substantial, much longer. Colossians is very, very short. And Romans contains a lot of Paul's deep, deep theology. It's a lot of people look to it as kind of his. He tried to get everything in that he could, so it contains a lot. Corinthians, there are two letters that we have to Corinthians. People even say there's probably a third that's been lost to history, but it's got two letters. And Corinthians, we know because it has a lot of stuff. If you've ever been to a wedding, you've probably heard something from Corinthians. It's got the whole love section that we love to read at weddings. And in that, we also have the words of institution for communion that we refer to. So Corinthians gets a fair amount of press that way. It's got lots of practical, intimate direction for a church. Galatians, Paul's letter to the Galatians, has a lot of personal narrative because he had a close connection there. Ephesians, that talks about love and respect. We've had a small group go a few times about love and respect, about marriage relationships. Ephesians has that, and it has the armor of God, and it's got what some scholars call the most expansive Christology, Paul's most expansive discussion of who Jesus is as the Christ. So it has that going for it. Colossians has a little bit. Philippians has got some beautiful poetic stuff in it. Thessalonians has these strong personal connections with the church there for Paul. Timothy, like this amazing personal mentorship that Paul had with Timothy. And then there's Titus and Philemon, which are just tiny little things. Almost don't show up. But Colossians then is kind of fits this unique spot. Not to like they're good books, but they're like a page. So they're kind of their own little class in and of themselves. But I don't know, Tony's got a but they have their place. Colossians has this unique place in that Paul never went to Colossae and he didn't have a real tight relationship with the church there. So it raises this question, why did Paul write this letter in particular? He had all sorts of reasons for writing these other ones, and they contain some very significant stuff. This letter is unique in that Paul didn't have a personal relationship. He didn't start the church at Colossae. He had somebody else had done it that he had a relationship with. So why would he write this letter? And then I think it raises an interesting relationship for us with it. Because if he wrote this letter to a church that he didn't have a personal connection with, he must have had some significant reasons for writing this letter. If he wrote this one letter, he must have included some things to it that were important. And he felt there were some things that were essential for them to take as a church for him to write to. And they were a young church. This is an interesting thing, I think, for us to grasp onto, is that they were a young church. That this was a brand new church that had been started, and they were young and up and coming. And so Paul writes this letter to a young church that he doesn't have much relationship with about some things that he thinks are essential to their growth and their development as a young congregation. Now, to place Colossae, geographically, we have a little map. It's in what now we call Turkey or Asia Minor, and it's down in the kind of southwest portion of it there. You can see it under where it says Poseida or Poseidia. There it is, just to the left there. And it is an interesting city. It was along trade routes, but around this time, when Paul was writing, Colossae was on this trade route, but it had started to fall into more decline than the cities around it. Particularly Laodicea and Hierapolis, Hierapolis, they had started to grow more as cities. And so Colossae is he's writing to a young church in a declining community along a trade route in the Roman world. And that's going to factor in heavily into this, that this is within the period of time in history when the Romans had conquered huge swaths of the known world all around the Mediterranean. And so they are in the midst of that. And being as close as they are to Greece, which is just off the map to the left there, they're very wrapped up in Greek thought and had had significant influence from Greek philosophy and all that kind of stuff in this area. So Paul writes this letter, this essential letter, and he has kind of two themes, and we're going to take a look at these two themes this week and then a theme this week and a theme next week. The first one that we're going to talk about is that Paul has this powerful insight into the outward life and the inward life in the way of Jesus. So this week we're going to look at what Paul has to say about the outward life in the way of Jesus. What is the outward life that we live if we're going to walk in the way of Jesus? And next week we're going to look more at the inward life and what does it look inwardly to walk in the way of Jesus. So, and for me personally, I really wanted to tackle this text because for Ann and me, whatever is the correct version of that, for me and Ann, this has been a, whatever, this is, English doesn't matter, I'm totally joking, this has been a powerful text for us because it confronts a number of things that we've been running into personally. And so as I was looking at this, I'm like, man, this is a lot of the stuff that we as a couple are sorting through and trying to figure out as we try and discover what does this outward life of following Jesus look like for us. So it has some personal connections there. So we're going to dive right in to Colossians here, if that's enough of an introduction for you. Colossians 1, we're going to start in verse 3. It'll be up on the screens. As well, and all, we'll go along as smoothly as possible, but I'll have to hit the brakes every once in a while. Paul says this, "We also thank God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, when we pray for you, because we have heard of your faith in Christ Jesus and the love you have for all his people, the faith and love that spring from the hope stored up for you in heaven, and about which you have already heard in the true word of the gospel, that has come to you in the same way. The gospel is bearing fruit and growing throughout the whole world, just as it has been among you since the day you heard it and truly understood God's grace." Let me hit pause there for just a second, and this is where we're going to get into a couple things. First one, truth. This idea of truth is mentioned two times, and this is a Greek word, aletheia. Aletheia. Get my lisp on there. Aletheia. Truth is, and it's defined, truth as the representation of what is and the realization of what ought to be. For a lot of people, as they read Colossians, this is a worldview text. This book is about how we understand truth and engage with the world around us, this outward way of following Jesus. So right away, Paul is establishing that what he's going to talk about here as he goes on is an understanding of what truth is. Because we tend to think that within our world, things are totally different and they've never been this way before. We have within our world what some people have called a war over truth. As we wrestle within our culture about what is truth and how do you define truth. Well, a lot of people think, well, that's never happened before. People have always had a clear understanding of what truth is. No, Paul is saying for the Colossians, they were running into these questions of what is truth and how do we understand what is true in the world that we live in? Because there are different factions with different ideas about what is true, and there are different power struggles around who gets to define what is true. So Paul's saying right here, he's lining this up and saying two times right away, this is about truth as we're going to run into it. And then he goes into this, and this is what the first of what we're going to call kind of Paul's Roman themes. And if you want to pull out the green sheet, we're going to start to fill in some of those blanks. But being that they were in the Roman world, Paul references some Roman themes. So bearing fruit in the whole world, Paul references, he uses those language in particular. Now, this was one of the prime time commercials, some of the prime propaganda that Caesar's political action committee was using at this time. These ideas of bearing fruit and throughout the whole world. This imperial fruitfulness and world domination is the ideas that Caesar was trying to make known throughout his world. That because of the empire, there was fruitfulness. Because of this huge, stable, all-encompassing military empire that was run by Caesar, there was fruitfulness. There were abundance and harvest. People were eating. People were making money. There was stable trade. So Caesar is projecting this idea, and also that this is a dominant political structure, that they have conquered the entire world. And so Paul, right away, launches into using that language to talk about this way of Jesus, talking about how that the fruitfulness of this is expanding, using that same language, turning it, and then using this whole idea of throughout the whole world, turning it. Now, Christianity, truth be told, historically, at this point, was popping up throughout the whole known world, but Paul knew full well that this wasn't spreading throughout the whole world in the way that he's using the language. He's using it to turn this idea that existed on its head a little bit, and in some ways, people would say, predicting what will happen, saying that this thing is spreading and it will continue to spread, that this is moving throughout the whole world and it will continue to spread. So Paul's letting them know that they're part of something that's bigger than themselves, that this little church in this dwindling town has now joined this movement that is big and it's getting bigger and it's going to continue to grow and to expand. So 7 continues like this. You learned it from Epaphras, our dear fellow servant, who is a faithful minister of Christ on our behalf, and who also told us of your love. So what we find out here is that this church was started by this guy named Epaphras, and this adds to and this establishes that tension that I alluded to before, that Paul didn't start this church, Epaphras did. And now Paul is speaking to this church. So it gives us this tension. If Paul didn't plant this church, why is he bothering to write to them? What is it that Paul has to say? So let's go. We're going to skip ahead to verse 15 and continue on and look at what is it that Paul had to say to this church. And we'll, again, not make it too far here before we'll have to hit the brakes. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. I told you when we wouldn't get far. The image of God, the firstborn of creation. This is, again, Roman language for Caesar. Caesar is the firstborn in the Roman propaganda. Caesar is the image of God. So Paul is using this imperial language to set up a conflict, kind of an internal conflict within his people, within the Colossian church, because they had been brought up their entire lives believing and being told that Caesar is the image of God, that Caesar is the firstborn among creation. So Paul is setting up this internal conflict, saying, you've heard this, but I'm going to tell you it this way. He's setting up this conflict, this Jesus versus Caesar idea. Continuing on, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. Again, the conflict. For Rome, they said that Caesar was the ultimate power. He was the ultimate ruler. He was the authority. Paul is saying that all of those things Jesus created, that Jesus created all power, all authority, that he doesn't just hold it, he created it. So it comes from him, that he is the origination, that he's the place for it. So even the thrones that Caesar sits on are thrones that Jesus created to begin with. So Caesar doesn't have a right to it because Jesus created it. So he continues on. So he's continued to build this internal conflict. Rome versus Jesus. 17, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in all spiritual things he might have supremacy. Does your Bible say that? Everything. Everything. He might have supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to recognize, to reconcile himself to all religious things. No? All things, right? Let me pull out a couple of things here. He's building on this conflict. Caesar allowed for a whole diversity of religious worship. You could worship any god you wanted to as long as you worship Caesar as well. There was religious practice everywhere. It's this idea of a Roman tolerance is the way I've worded it in your notes if you want to grab that. There's this religious tolerance of anything was fine as long as you worshiped Caesar too. But what we have Paul coming in and saying is saying, no, all things are held together in Jesus. And you could say that this is the pass verse. The Greek here is this word pass for all. And this word shows up 8 times in these 5 verses. This Greek word pass that talks about all, we translate it everything and all in there, or all things, a few times, is this idea of all. So what Paul is doing is saying the Romans have this idea of inclusiveness, that you can believe anything you want as long as you believe this too. But what Paul is doing is saying that all things, regardless of what you believe, all things are centered on and found in and redeemed in Jesus. That Jesus is supreme over all of it. That all of it comes under Jesus. Not Jesus and, but Jesus and then. So Jesus is above and over everything, and that everything comes from Jesus. So this idea, Paul keeps harping on and bringing up the language here. It's tough because we translated a couple different ways. But for the Colossians, as they read it, they would have been just, the word would have come up over and over and over. All things, everything, all of it, all of these things, all of it centers on and comes from Jesus. So he's building up this showing the disparity. Rome says, these things are all fine as long as Caesar is there too. But with Jesus, everything comes down from him and everything is his. There is no split life allowed within the kingdom of heaven. Within Rome, you can split your life up in as many ways as you want, but within the way of Jesus, there has to be a centrality to it. All of it has to come from this center place with Jesus. Finishing up, I'm going to do 19 again. For God was pleased to have all of his fullness in him, and through him reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on a cross. So this last idea in your notes, Pax Romana. You may have run into this. The conflict that Paul is setting up here is that this is also written right in the midst of what many historians would call the Roman peace, or the Pax Romana. That Rome has expanded territorially to close to its greatest geographic influence. And in so much, they've not stopped entirely, but they've slowed their military campaigns to conquest new land, and they've started to focus their foreign and domestic policy back on security and prosperity. So they've turned their foreign and domestic policy away from their borders so much and back in on themselves and talking about prosperity and security within themselves as a nation. And there were these ideas being widely spread throughout the Roman Empire of this Roman peace. That look at how wonderful Caesar is. Because of his sword, we have peace. They had stations all over the country of basically policing with the Roman soldiers, where there was a standing military force that would enforce the laws. Like, this makes sense to us. Like, we have police. We understand this. But for the ancient world, there was a lot of times and a lot of places where there was general disorder, and the person who had the biggest sword or the most people on their side would win in any given conflict. And so there was always this sense of insecurity. But Rome had brought about this vast prosperity and security because of their empire, because of their sword. And one of their, ironically enough, one of their greatest implements of perpetuating the peace was the cross. Because if anyone threatened the peace, if there was anyone who stepped out of line within the Roman Empire, you would sustain the peace by putting them on the cross. So Paul takes this understanding, this Roman idea, and he talks about peace from an entirely different perspective, though. He says that in opposition to this, the peace that Jesus has won is not with the sword, but with his own blood. And this peace that comes from Jesus is sustained not with the threat of the cross, but is sustained with this love that God has shown through the cross. So it is this conflict that Paul was establishing for the Corinthians to wrestle through of this is what Rome tells us. And Paul's using the same language to help us understand this way of living in harmony with Jesus. So he's setting up this conflict. So here we have Paul writing a letter to a group of Roman Gentiles who, real brief note, apparently didn't have much Jewish influence. A lot of the early churches had heavy Jewish, or a lot of the early Christian churches had heavy Jewish influence. Apparently this one didn't have a ton. Paul references it some, but it's almost as passing. Some of the scholars think there may have been some, but not a huge amount of Jewish influence here, who have heard about this good news, this gospel, which coincidentally is another Roman term, by the way, but I won't go into that. It'll be all Roman Sunday. This gospel is that there is a God who has begun to change the world that they live in through this Jesus, who is this God's son, and through this Jesus, all things were created, the whole world and everything in it. And that even though this Jesus was executed by the Roman cross because he was a threat to the Roman peace, he is risen from the dead and he has ascended to heaven and is returning to redeem the whole world. That there is this hope that he will return to redeem. And until then, his followers are to begin this redemptive process, to begin changing the world that they live in. So Paul is writing this new community of believers in order to help them embrace and understand this way of Jesus by contrasting it with the way of Rome. So this is what Paul's doing. He's trying to help them grasp and embrace the way of Jesus by contrasting it with the culture and the world that they live in. Now we find the most expansive explanation of the way of Jesus in Matthew, the longest kind of full section of Jesus talking about what it means to be one of his followers. Matthew chapter 5, Sermon on the Mount is one of the popular terms about it. And I just want to pull out some of the highlights. It's two chapters worth of stuff. But I just want to pull out some of the highlights around which Jesus teaches this massive humanity. The way that the story gets set up, it's this huge eclectic group of humanity that Jesus is teaching. I think the official term would be riffraff, is what we would call this group, from all sorts of circumstances, many of them probably very poor because there's some food issues involved. But here are some of the things that Jesus outlines as the cores to what it means to follow Jesus or to live in the way of Jesus. He says this, that blessed are the poor in spirit, which is totally counter to what we would think because people who are blessed aren't poor in spirit. The people who are blessed are the ones who have their spiritual lives together, right? Like that's how we understand the world is when you know it, that's when your spiritual life is together. But Jesus says, no, blessed are those who don't have it all together and haven't figured it out yet. They're blessed. Blessed are those who mourn. Again, that doesn't make sense. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Not blessed are the righteous. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Blessed are you, I love this one, when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you. Because that seems like a blessing. I'm just saying. Last time you were insulted, you're like, oh, God totally just blessed me there. Evidently, you should. You are salt of the earth. You are light of the world. Anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Anyone who slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them your other cheek also. So when someone attacks you, when someone tries to steal your humanity by assaulting you, the response Jesus is saying here is not to rob them of their humanity, but demand that your own be recognized. You're going to assault me? You're going to hit me here? Hit me here too. There's a great thing there, but we won't go into it. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you? Really? This is the way Jesus wants to go about it? To love them? Those people? This is what Jesus is saying. When you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Don't worry about your life, what you eat or drink, about your body, what you wear. Do not judge or you will be judged. Ask, seek, knock. So here we have Jesus establishing his way. And again, given, you know, if we wanted to stick around till 5, we could dive into huge amounts of Jesus is taking this and putting it in culturally to help his audience understand what it is that he's doing and saying and how that is separate and how that stands against their culture. But Jesus is doing that. So Paul, following Jesus' example, is describing a specific way of life that is in tune with the melodies of the kingdom of heaven. And I think that's something you can write in your notes there, I believe. Yeah, that Paul, following Jesus' example, is describing a specific way of life that is in tune with the melodies of the kingdom of heaven. Paul is translating the melody of the kingdom of heaven in the context of the Colossians and is to listen to both the melodies and pursue the life that is in tune with the way of Jesus as defined by Jesus in Matthew and explained by Paul in Colossians. So this tune and this melody, Paul and Jesus are both talking about a way of life that is in tune with the melody of the kingdom of heaven. So I started thinking about this musical language as I was working on it this week. And as I was thinking about this musical language, it got me thinking. You know, I've grown up in the church. I've grown up in churches. And I have always grown up. Every church I've ever been a part of for any significant amount of time has had the full band set up. So I've been around all sorts of musical instruments for my entire church as far back as I can remember, and particularly guitars. Guitars have been a mainstay of what I've grown up listening to. So I was just doing some quick math, and it's something like I've been a part of easily 2,500 live worship sets in my lifetime. Easily. That's like low estimate. Easily over 10,000 songs I've sung with a live worship band. Well over 700 hours of live music with guitars in particular. So because of my vast exposure to the art of guitar playing, I decided, and I don't play guitar, by the way, just FYI, not yet, just you wait and see. I took it up for about a month in college, borrowed a guitar from a friend, but I decided since I have this vast exposure, I mean 10,000 hours or 10,000 songs, thousands of hours of being around this, I figured I should be able to pick up something. So I got in touch with James, and I'm going to challenge him to a little guitar battle here. I went on YouTube this week, and Phil brought a guitar over Wednesday. I went on YouTube, and I even have a pick in my pocket. It's like, Phil's like, oh, he's like a real guitar player. He always has a pick on him. Which leg is it? It's this one that goes up. All right. Now, you guys are usually a very respectful audience. Let's keep that in mind. But this is a bit. So heckling, absolutely appropriate. Cheering in some circumstances would be more appropriate than others. Making snarky comments to the person next to you, please do. Where's my cheat sheet? I can't read what chords actually are yet, so I have a little chart. So the way this is going to work, so I've set myself up here to obviously demonstrate the point here. James, we're going to do a battle style, and if you've never been to a battle, he'll play, I'll play, he'll play, and then we'll decide, you, me, then we'll decide who wins, and the winner can take a victory lap. So, guitar speaking. All right, so let's see what you got. Okay. I've got this. I've got this. Down, 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 up. All right.
Where'd the chord go? Right there.
What do you got? Are these the same? I don't... Like that was better than anything I could do. Will that help me?
No, it might help
James. Oh. Like, he needs more. Where am I doing? That one right there? I think video would be more effective. Oh, wait, right there. And... All right, winner, I think. Let's hear one more. Let's hear one more. Amazing. Let's give James a hand. All right, there is a point. There always is a point. I wouldn't embarrass myself that way if there weren't a point. This is what we call commitment to a bit. I've actually bled in commitment to bits up on front before, but that's a different story. There is a contrast. I have sat in and been a part of hours and hours and hours and hours of guitar playing. I have witnessed it. I've listened to it. I've enjoyed it. But like I said, a couple YouTube videos, Wednesday, 5 minutes a day for the last 4 days. I do kind of have almost calluses built up now. Talking to Phil on Friday, he's like, you better be careful. You don't have blisters on, like, blood pouring from my hands. I'm trying to do that. There's this contrast of practicing and listening to. And for many of us, we need to grasp this when it comes to what we do when we come to this room. Because this room and what we do within church, the singing and the listening to someone up front, talking about the Bible, talking about life, and then going out from here is not going to enable you to sit and play that melody, that tune of the way of Jesus in your life in a significant way. You'll look like this. This is the result of appreciating it and enjoying listening to it. James is a result of engaging with the guitar and amazing what you've been playing for how many years? 12 years, and have devoted an incredible amount of time to practice and engaging in the art of it, learning from others. And I mean, James is phenomenal. And this is just a small sample of what he's capable of because he's devoted himself to it and has engaged it in ways outside of this. I like the guitar. I think it's a cool instrument. I enjoy listening to it. But I've, for about a month in college, I engaged it in a real way in the last 4 days, 5 minutes a day, and a couple YouTube videos. If we want to engage in the melody, if we want to understand the tune of the melody of the kingdom of heaven, engaging in that melody needs to be done, and learning that tune needs to be done in a much more expansive way than what we engage in here. It needs to go with you in real and significant ways into the rest of your life. So if I were to take some of what Paul teaches us to do, if I were to follow Paul's lead in tuning the message of the way of Jesus to the world that he lived in, I would have some things that would go like this. For us personally, I talked about this, saying that me and Ann were wrestling through some of these ideas for Colossians. I've got a photo of us from a few years back. This is 2001. We bought this house there in the background. That's us in front of our sold sign. And we were checking the mic earlier. I was like, and that's the house we've been stuck in ever since. We bought the house. We were like a lot of people buying their first home. We were dinks, dual income, no kids. We're dual income, no kids. We kind of fell into the house. We didn't have any real intentional thought put into where we lived and why we lived there and how that would influence our ability to live the way of Jesus. We hadn't thought through it. We fell into the house through the ways a lot of people fall into home where they live. You know, we looked around, reasonably close to work, but we didn't think through intentionally what that would mean for how we follow Jesus. And now, literally, we are. We feel a strong pull and a strong desire to move to an urban neighborhood that where we can be in a setting where our kids are going to have friends who are much different from us culturally and ethnically, whose family structures are going to be much different from our own, because we believe that we, and again, this is about what Ann and I feel called. I'm not trying to project this on anyone else. We feel called toward that type of setting and walking out what it means to follow Jesus in that way. God has been developing this melody in our hearts that we want to find a way to tune our lives around. And for us, because of the housing market and a number of other factors, we've been literally stuck in this house and haven't been able to move. So we've been struggling with this because we didn't think through on the front end. 8 years ago, we weren't wrestling with this. We weren't opening our hearts up to this melody. So here's what I want to throw. If I were going to say, here are some of the propaganda that we have in our world. And I'm going to follow Paul's lead and say, here are some of the things that we're aware of in our world, and here are some of the ways that we could, that I think following the way of Jesus would rub up against some of these things. And some things like this. The idea of urban sprawl, which connects very well with what I'm saying. That have you intentionally thought about, from a theological perspective, where you live and why you live there? Where you work and why you work there. Where you go to school and why you go to school there. What are the relationships? There is a theology. There should be a theology to the place, the space in which we find ourselves. Because proximity is so important. We live in an e-world, but there's something to be said about proximity. Who are the people that you rub shoulders with? Are you thinking intentionally about what it means to rub shoulders with those people from a kingdom of heaven perspective? What is the melody that God has put in your heart for the space, for the people in the space around you intentionally? To think about that. Another propaganda thing, that's another phrase that's used a lot, is the idea of the green movement. And apart from what that means politically, but just the idea that when it comes to the poor and our desire for compassion for the poor, the poor in our world contribute least to pollution. The poor in our world consume the least and contribute the least to pollution, but they suffer the effects of pollution more than anyone. There is a disproportionate relationship between contributing to pollution and suffering the effects of pollution when it comes to the poor. And we should be aware of that and consider what that means for us when it comes to following in the way of Jesus. And again, this is the great part of my job. I don't have the answers about that. It's just my job to raise the question. Because it is your job to go to lunch and start talking about this. When you go away, to be wrestling through this. It's my job to stick the thorn in you, and it's your job to come to peace with it between you and God and the community that you live in and those closest to you. Another one, the idea of bipartisan politics. If you align yourself to one party, either party, I have no dog in the fight at all when it comes to which party you align yourself to. I have my own ideas, but that's fine. But you pick a side and align yourself with that side, and you are going to be neglecting significant portions of the teaching of Jesus. Both ways. Pick a way. Part of the party platform will significantly neglect parts of what it means to follow Jesus. Both parties do this. So when you play that game, you're going to be neglecting a significant portion of what Jesus says is important and why he says it's important. Global capitalism. Discount stores, they offer us low prices every day. But do those savings come at a cost of someone else's freedom, someone else's dignity, someone else's blood? What does that 10% save us and cost someone else? And the idea of the sexual revolution. If your sexuality is the primary definition of your humanity, if the gratification of your own needs is the primary definition of who you are as a person, then you're out of tune what it means to be a real human. You are defined by more than your desires as God sees it. There is more to who you are than your gratification. And that is a beautiful thing. No matter where you're coming to with that, there is more to you as a human being than that part of what makes you who you are. And within our culture, that defines so many people exclusively. There's more to being human than that. The text of Colossians is Paul's inspired, I believe, following Jesus' example of what it means to live in tune with the melodies of the kingdom of heaven. We need to increasingly discover these melodies and order our lives in such a way where we begin to follow the tune. Let me pray. I'm gonna invite the worship team. We're gonna close with some songs. So I'm gonna invite them up. We're also gonna receive our offering at this time as well. So if you have some for that, or we're gonna present our offering to the Lord. So let me pray, and we'll move into worship. Lord, we are challenged. We do stand and have great resonance and great difficulty with understanding. What does it mean to walk in this way? What does it mean to resonate with your melody and to walk in tune with it? Lord, we pray that you would take these rubs and these thorns and work them out. Lord, help us understand what it means to live by this tune and walk in our lives. In your name, amen.